Welcome to the Original Gangsters News Network and podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. I am very thrilled to bring on a retired FBI agent from the Boston office, Jeff Kelly, who has written a book all about his two decades working the Isabella Gardner Museum robbery case. It's the most infamous art heist in American history, $500 million of pilfered precious works of art from Rembrandt and a lot of Meniere, a lot of very Jeff, first, thank you for coming aboard.
And my pleasure.
I don't want to steal your thunder. Tell us who, tell us the names of the artists who had their works taken off the walls and of the museum in Boston, and it hasn't been returned. We haven't found any of the artwork, haven't arrested anybody, and we're going on 35 years, 36 years.
Coming up on 36. Yeah, so there were 13 pieces that were taken. A few Rembrandts, a piece that was misattributed to Rembrandt, and then there's a painting called The Concert by Vermeer, which is really the world's largest, the world's most valuable piece of stolen art out there. It's an incredible piece. There's like 36 Vermeers in the world. There were some pieces that were kind of lesser value, some sketches. There was a Chinese beaker that's called a gu, and the top of a Napoleonic flag pole called that's a finial. So it looks like a golden eagle.
And your book's called 13 Perfect Fugitives, being released by Simon & Schuster. It's out wherever books are purchased. And let's just kind of dive right into the deep end of the ocean here. We've talked about the museum robbery on the podcast in the past. We've never had a true blue expert on it until you came on today. So let's kind of just, start from the beginning and take us through your, well, first of all, just give us a synopsis of the event and then take us through start kind of just from square one and how you started investigating and where your investigation took.
Yeah, sure. No, I'd be happy to. So it happened on March 18th of 1990, which was just past midnight. And St. Patrick's Day just wrapped up in Boston. And, you know, this was not by design. I think our subjects knew that the Boston cops were going to be tied up elsewhere, breaking up parties and bar fights on St. Patty's Day. So it was an auspicious time to pull off the heist. And it was 1:24 in the morning. There's two guards who are working the overnight shift at the museum. And, you know, just take a step back. When you're looking at overnight guards in a museum, these guys are not, you know, tactical ninjas. They're not going to go hands-on with anybody. Really, the main reason why you have guards in a museum after hours is in the event of fire or flood. If it wasn't for that, museums would probably just lock the place up and leave it empty for the night. But because of those dangers, very real dangers, especially in an old museum like the Gardner Museum, it's more than 100 years old, you want to have people there on the overnight shift for just that eventuality. And so about 1:24 in the morning, the service bell rings. The guard who's working the night shift, his name is Rick Abbott. He's got command of the watch desk, which is kind of the command console. And he presses the intercom, asks who's there. They say it's Boston police. They're responding to a call of a disturbance. And against protocol, Rick lets them into the museum. And it's two guys who are dressed like Boston cops. They instruct him to get his partner down, and Rick calls him over the radio. And once they've got the two of them there, one of the cops says to him, like, hey, I think there might be a warrant for your arrest. Let me see some ID. And so Rick proffers his driver's license, and the guy's like, yeah, I think there is a warrant. Come around from behind the desk. And in doing so, he got Rick away from the panic button that, if pressed, will immediately summon the real police. And once they've got them out, they tell him to assume the position. And Rick and his partner, Randy, who've seen episodes of T.J. Hooker and Starsky and Hutch, go and, you know, slap the wall. And after they're handcuffed, the subjects tell them, gentlemen, this is a robbery. This starts off, listen, right out of Hollywood. And it's going to slowly kind of get less and less Hollywood as the investigation continues. But these two subjects take the guards down into the basement, lock them up, handcuff them to parts of the basement as far away from each other as they can, which was really suspicious to me. They were like diametrically opposed in opposite corners of this massive basement, you know, that stretches nearly a city block. And then the subject spent the next hour going through the museum. They went through two galleries and they removed these 13 pieces of art, paintings, like I said, the top of a flagpole, a little beaker, some sketches. They were methodical. They were almost leisurely in how they did it. I mean, 81 minutes for an art heist is just unheard of in the annals of art theft. They loaded up the paintings and they were gone by 2:45 in the morning. They just pulled off the world's largest art heist.
And let me just interject. The reason that you're on OG Pod and the reason that, I shouldn't say the reason, one of the reasons that this case has garnered so much interest is that there are a lot of or possible mob ties, potential mob ties involving multiple La Cosa Nostra crime families, both at the start of this in terms of the robbery itself, and then in the years afterwards, the attempts to move the stolen art on the black market. We hear about the Patriarca crime family, which is headquartered, as everybody knows, out of Boston and Providence. Jeff, you were an FBI agent in Boston. Eventually, as the investigation goes on, and you'll get into this, the Philadelphia Mafia gets brought into the conversation. But can you talk before you dive into the nitty gritty of your investigation? Can you just follow up the synopsis with what the mafia angle is here, or what the suspected mafia angle is? Because we don't have a ton of concrete answers in terms of adjudication. We have no answers, but there's been a mob. This has been mentioned as a mob crime, and I think there's some truth to it, but maybe not 100% truth to it.
Yeah, I don't think the crime itself was pulled off by the mob. We believe that the crime was pulled off by a crew of local mobsters operating out of the Dorchester section of Boston. They were into drug trafficking and other illicit activities. They weren't part of a made family by any means. But through the investigation, we were able to trace at least some of these paintings went up to Maine, and they were hidden in a residence of a guy named Bobby Guarenti, who was known as Unc. And I got some very credible information telling me that the paintings had gone up there and they were hidden in a hide up at his farmhouse. I went up there with my colleague from the Gardner Museum, Anthony Amore. We worked very closely together on this case and searched the house. It was abandoned. And sure enough, there was a hide just like it was described. So Bobby Guarenti now is where now we're going to start getting into mob ties.
It gets confusing.
Yeah, and it's to try and keep it simple. But so Bobby Guarenti worked for a guy named Bobby Luisi, and went into everybody's name Bobby, so that it's going to make it very easy. Right. So you don't worry about first names.
Bobby Guarenti, Bobby Gentile, and Bobby Luisi. Yeah,
just assume that everybody's named Bobby, and you can't go wrong. But Bobby Guarenti worked for a guy named Bobby Luisi. Bobby Luisi was running a drug trafficking organization up in Boston at the time. And we'll talk about Luisi in just a minute. But Guarenti and his partner, this guy named Bobby Gentile, who lived down in Manchester, Connecticut, they were both bodyguards for Bobby Luisi. But Bobby Luisi was running his operation in Boston. He was kind of at odds with the Rossetti family in the North End. And he was seeking protection. He was rebuffed by the Gambinos down in New York. So then he tried down in Philadelphia, and skinny Joey Merlino agreed to make Luisi and his crew. And so they got straightened out. Looks like probably about 96, 97. And in return for getting made by the Philly crew, Luisi was kicking back $10,000 a month from his drug trafficking business down to Philly. And so that's how we start getting tied into the Philly angle.
And let me also want to color up something I said a couple minutes ago with, you know, people can sometimes get tied up on semantics and what exactly is a mob crime or was it commissioned? And what I think we can say there's some gray area between something that is, you know, from the top down, a conspiracy where a mafia don sends orders to lower level people to go do a robbery. I don't think that's what happened here, but
no.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the people, before we get to the Bobbies and the Philadelphia stuff, the people that you mentioned out of Dorchester, and I know there was, I believe, some ties into the North End from those Dorchester guys. They were mobsters, but they weren't necessarily made guys or part of some overall conspiracy by the leaders of the Patriarca family to rob the museum. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, no, that's an accurate statement, Scott. And so it's a weird thing when you're looking at art theft in Massachusetts. It's a very unique creature. And the best way to talk about it is to kind of take a look historically at art theft in Massachusetts and how it intertwines so well with other criminal elements. But the first armed robbery of a museum in U.S. history occurred in central Massachusetts in a city called Worcester back in 1972. And this pretty effective and knowledgeable art thief by the name of Al Munday, he got four of his guys together and they went and they committed an armed robbery of the Worcester Art Museum. They stole four pieces. Notably, one of the pieces that they stole was a Rembrandt. And one of the guys ended up shooting a guard. And so this was really a first for art theft. We typically had never seen this before. And Munday took these paintings and he hid them right over the state line in Rhode Island on a pig farm. And when a Worcester local criminal, a guy by the name of Chucky Carlo, he heard about the score, he was looking at some significant time of his own. He had a pending charge over his head. And so what he did was he just basically kidnapped Al Munday, you know, put a gun in his ribs and said, give me the paintings. And so Munday complied and gave him the paintings. And Chucky Carlo went and returned them. And he ended up getting a really nice break on a pending sentence that he was looking at. So this is something like Boston thieves kind of take notice that like this Rembrandt was successfully used to help out on a criminal case. And so we go forward 3 years and now we're up to 1975 and there's a very prolific, very talented art thief by the name of Miles Connor. He's kind of like
the Thomas Crown of New England, right?
As close as you can get to the Thomas Crown affair, it's going to be Miles Connor. He's brilliant. He's a member of Mensa. And he's one of those few outliers who liked to steal for not just financial gain. He sometimes would make financial gain from it, but he might do it because a museum director insulted him or because he particularly liked a piece. He collected Asian art. In fact, his first burglary he ever did of an art museum was in his hometown of Milton, and he stole these Asian treasures. So he got locked up. He did a burglary up in Monmouth, Maine, the Woolworth summer house, the 5 and 10 family. And he got arrested when he tried to sell these Wyeth paintings to an undercover FBI agent. And so he was looking at 13 years in prison because he already had a pretty lengthy criminal history. He once escaped from a jail up in Maine by fashioning a gun out of a bar of soap. It really did happen. You know, you've seen it so many times in the movies, but he literally did that. And in fact, the soap gun is still on display up at the museum at the jail.
Let me throw out an anecdote I heard about Miles Connor, and I have no idea if it's true or if it's just mythology, but I heard from some of sources that I have that he sometimes would break into museums, not to necessarily steal, but to like sleep with the artifacts. Like that's how, you know, kind of how obsessed
I've never heard that. I'm not going to deny it. I've just never heard it. But, right. You know, like For one example, he was out at a museum, I think it was the Mead Museum out in Western Mass, and he wanted to talk with the director of the museum about a piece of art, and the director just insulted him and kind of looked down his nose at Miles. And so Miles decided that he was going to come back and rob the place just to get back at the guy. Like that was Miles' motivations. And I've spoken to Miles so many times over the years in my fishing.
Oh, you've talked. Okay. You've said, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've talked to a couple people that knew him, but yeah, we've spoken many times.
Yeah. And in fact, he was kind enough to sit down and let me interview him for the book.
Oh, awesome.
So Miles is looking at 13 years in prison and he's out on bail. And he's talking to a friend of the family who's a state trooper. And he says to him, how am I going to get away with this? How am I going to get out of this? And the trooper's answer is really meant to be hyperbolic. He says, Miles, you're going to need a Rembrandt. And it wasn't meant to be literal, but Miles took him literally. And so he went and committed a daytime smash and grab at the Museum of Fine Arts in downtown Boston. And what did he steal? He stole a Rembrandt. He ended up returning that Rembrandt. Instead of getting 13 years, he got 28 months. So you can use it
as leverage, as a bargaining chip.
Yeah. Now there's two occasions in Massachusetts where Boston thieves are seeing that Rembrandts are used for leverage. And then 3 years later, somebody steals a Rembrandt from a private residence in a town just on the south shore of Massachusetts, Cohasset, and Miles helps return it to repay the favor from his trooper friend to get the piece back. So this is like a common thread. And believe me, it's no coincidence that when the robbery occurs in 1990, that our subjects made a beeline for the Dutch Room, which is the gallery where all the Rembrandts are kept. And there's a lot of beautiful pieces in there of Dutch masters. There's Holbeins and Durers and Rubens, but they went on a Rembrandt shopping spree. That's what they wanted, because Boston thieves know that Rembrandts can be like a get out of jail free card. And in fact, I talked to Miles he first told me this years ago, but he admitted that he and Bobby Donati, who was a member of Miles's crew, Carmelo Merlino's crew, they cased the museum. Like they had every intention of breaking into the museum and robbing it. But Miles got locked up at the time. So Miles was in custody and Miles is very confident that Bobby Donati, who worked for Merlino, went and pulled it off without him.
Well, Jeff, let me ask you a question. I'm by no means am I trying to contradict you, because sure. you're the authority. And I know Bobby Donati had definite connections to Merlino, but wasn't Bobby Donati like best friends with Vinnie Ferrara?
With
Vinnie Ferrara. I mean, in Vinnie Ferrara, all due respect to Carmelo Merlino, who had that auto body shop that everybody used to hang out in Dorchester, but you know, Vinnie Ferrara was a big, big, big name. I mean, Carmelo Merlino wasn't necessarily garnering headlines the way Vinnie the Animal was.
Exactly. And Vinnie got locked up about 6 months before the heist occurred and was in custody. And there was a lot of speculation that Donati may have wanted to try and help out Vinnie. In fact, Ferrara got indicted the same week as the Garden Museum heist, by coincidence.
Right. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to see if I was mistaken with connecting Donati to Ferrara.
Right. No. But that's the thing. And there's this kind of like you see a lot of interconnectivity between different criminal elements up in Boston at the time. And you're seeing like Miles Connor, but is also friends with Bobby Guarenti, who works for Merlino. Like, it's, you know, there are made members of organized crime up in Boston. And then there's guys like Merlino and his crew.
Right. And let's also for people that might be consuming this that don't have the scorecard in front of them, there are two Merlinos in this scenario. There's Carmelo Merlino, who's the Boston mobster that has the auto body shop in Dorchester, where a lot of people hang out, where a lot of his crew members were connected to the front end of this. And then you have Skinny Joey Merlino, no relation to Carmelo Merlino, who's the boss down in Philadelphia, where the three Bobbies, Bobby Guarenti, Bobby Gentile, and Bobby Luisi end up linking up with in 96, 97. So I just want to make sure people.
Yeah, I think everybody should have a scorecard. You're right. If you're going to sit here and go over this case, because it does get confusing, and it's you can't just say Bobby because there's just too many. Right. You got more specific than that. But yeah, so that's kind of the environment we were in 1990 when this robbery went down. And I think there was a belief that these paintings were going to be held onto for a period of time, and then they were going to come back if somebody got jammed up, or maybe they're going to ransom them back, but it's going to go back as some kind of reward. But unwittingly, these guys pulled off the world's largest art heist. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, that this little museum in Boston that not too many people had heard of, they steal some paintings. You know, the Worcester Art Museum didn't really make much of a splash outside of central Massachusetts. But when this thing went down, it just went nuclear. And, you know, there were repercussions all throughout the United States and across Europe that this robbery had taken place. And I think it was too hot. And I think as a result of it, and the involvement of the FBI right from the beginning, I think that these guys wanted to take care of loose ends. And over the following year and a half after the robbery occurred, we had three guys who had association with the robbery were violently murdered, including Bobby Donati. And then a fourth guy died under some really suspicious circumstances that probably was also a homicide.
You had a number of guys that were either directly implicated or indirectly through connections to people that were implicated that died or were killed in the direct aftermath in the next couple, not just the next, I think there was the 18 months you mentioned, then I think in 94, 95, Charlie Pappas.
Yeah, Charlie Pappas.
Killed. So there was five people that had some connection to this that were killed or died under suspicion.
Yeah, Pappas was part of Merlino's crew. Pappas was going to testify in a home invasion case, as well as a burglary that occurred at the Bull and Finch, which is a bar in downtown Boston, which is the Cheers bar is modeled after. Yeah, so yeah, there was a lot of homicides, and it's going to have a chilling effect on anybody who's harboring any aspirations to come forward and maybe provide some information. And by the same token, I think some of these paintings may have been hidden, and the secret of where they were hidden went to the graves with at least some of these guys. You know, Bobby Donati, he was murdered on his front porch. Mm-hmm. His body was found in the trunk of his Cadillac a few days later. He'd been stabbed multiple times, beaten, and nearly decapitated. And the responding Revere police, when they went to the house, they saw that the front door had been jimmied and the house had been ransacked, like his killers were looking for something. And so I don't think any of that is by coincidence. I interviewed a jeweler who was in downtown Boston who told me that 6 weeks after the heist, Bobby Donati came into his shop with this package and he unwrapped it right there on the counter. And it was the finial from the Napoleonic flag, one of the 13 items that was stolen. And he said, how much is this thing worth? And the jeweler said, it's worth nothing. He's like, I don't want to touch it. Wait, spot. I don't want it. He recognized it immediately. So, you know, and so when you've got, and it was credible information. And so you've got 6 weeks after the heist, you've got one of the members of Merlino's crew with possession of one of the pieces. And then a year later, you know, year and a half later, he's murdered violently and his house is ransacked. It really makes you wonder what they were looking for.
I want to throw another thing in there because I think context matters and timelines matter. And I guess I'm just interested in your take on the climate that this took place during. So this takes place, like you said, St. Patrick's Day or the end of St. Patrick's Day, 1990. And for all of you mob historians out there, and I'm sure for somebody that was from the area like yourself, this was right in the middle of a mafia war that was taking place in New England and lasted on and off between 1989 and the mid 90s when Cadillac Frank Salemi finally got locked up. So you had a very unstable mafia landscape that was already in existence when this heist takes place. And like when you're talking about Bobby Donati, and it's like Donati has, from what I've learned, and please always feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, Donati had his foot in kind of both of these situations.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're gonna, you see it also when you jump forward a little bit with Luisi. I mean, that's the reason why Luisi, he right. believed the mob up in Boston was unstable, and he wanted a little bit of stability and he wanted protection. And that's the reason why he ended up going down to Philly.
Right.
You know, which is very strange. I'm not a mob expert, but that's an unusual thing to start looking that far to try and get protection. But, you know, for Philly, $10,000 a month to get a piece of the action on everything that was coming up in Boston was a pretty good deal. And it worked for a while until the FBI got involved.
And Bobby Luisi was fortunate. He got an introduction to Joey and his guys from Ralph Natale, who was the official boss. Joey Merlino was the unofficial boss at that point.
Yeah.
And somebody that Bobby knew had done time with Ralph Natale, and Natale maneuvered the guys in Boston that didn't want to be under the Patriarchal banner and brought them to Philly to meet with Merlino's guys. Merlino's guys actually became, it wasn't just a business relationship. These guys became friends.
Yeah.
Merlino's crew and Bobby Luisi and those guys, they were going on vacations together to Disneyland.
Yeah.
But to your point, it's not par for the course or a traditional mob protocol for a family in New England to or for a family in Philadelphia to have a New England crew. And I will just finish up saying one more thing, and I don't know if you're aware of it or not, and I digress, but that crew, almost 30 years later, is still active. And a lot of those people that originally, not the Bobbies, but the guys that were working with the Bobbies, those guys are back there running it again. The crew went dormant for a little bit when guys went to prison. But in about 10 years ago, it got back up and running. And Bobby, a couple of Bobby's guys, one of them, I don't have a problem saying it, I'll say it, Sean. Sean is the capo of that crew now. So
yeah, it's you know, they were so decimated after 99 with the undercover operation that ended up, you know, Ron Previti was working for the FBI and basically introduced Boston Undercover, who again, Mike, I interviewed him in my book.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. And you know, it was interesting when, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but we did mention Bobby Gentile, the guy, Guarenti's buddy, who was down in Manchester, Connecticut. When I first heard about him, I reached out to Mike. He was the undercover coordinator for the Boston FBI at the time, and he's just a phenomenal agent and a wealth of information. And he was the undercover who was, you know, that they were coming to for the drug deals and that the 2 kilos that Luisi ended up getting jammed up on. But Mike told me that Bobby Gentile was present for all of these meetings that they were having. But he told me, and I remember distinctly when he told me this, he said, you know, Bobby Gentile, he didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he didn't touch drugs, he stayed away from women. He just stood in the corner and took it all in. And when the indictments came down, Gentile didn't get indicted because they had nothing on him, because he never said a word. He never made one incriminating statement. And that is so indicative of Bobby Gentile's personality. He is very low key. He's very self-effacing. And after we took it down in 2012, we can get back. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but Jamie Lawton, who is my partner on this, he's an outstanding
friend of the show.
Yeah,
one of the great G-men from Connecticut. And
just a tremendous resource. Yeah, just a tremendous
wealth resource of information.
Yeah, and crucial to this investigation, you know. And we went after we locked up Bobby Gentile on a drug charge. We went down to interview Luisi down in Allenwood, And Luigi was very polite, very friendly. We had a very candid conversation. And, you know, he told me a story. He told us a story about Gentile, which really spoke volumes and kind of underpins his whole personality. When he was working for Luisi, Luisi wanted to buy some new cars. And so they went to a Lincoln dealership, and Luisi wanted to buy four brand new black Lincoln Continentals, you know, like some type of presidential motorcade.
Like a fleet. Yeah.
Yeah. And he told us that Gentile was furious and, you know, just yelling at him, like, what are you doing? You're going to get the feds on it. You know, you got to drive old cars. You got to drive old Junkers. And that was Bobby Gentile. I mean, when we were dealing with him when I first dealt with him in 2010, he was still driving these old Buicks that were like 20 years old. I mean, that's just the way he was. He was very low key, very crafty. And you know, it's really hard, especially in a RICO case. It's very hard to jam somebody up in an investigation when they just don't open their mouth. And that was Bobby Gentile.
Well, Bobby Guarante and Bobby Gentile were OGs. I mean, they were 20 years older than Bobby Luisi.
Yeah.
They came from a different generation. Bobby Luisi came up in the 80s and 90s. Bobby Guarante and Bobby Gentile came up in the 50s and 60s. There's a difference in mob, you know, protocol back then. At that time period, let's go and just, I know we're, again, you said we're all over the place, but this is so fascinating. I hope people can keep up with us. And we're going to be bringing
let's
Jeff
do a flow,
on.
Let's do a flow chart.
Flow chart. I'm going to quote a great, The Town, which I hope you've seen that movie. I love it. And there's a scene where one of the guys said, you need a Venn diagram to keep up with these guys.
I got to jump in. Actually, I was a technical consultant on The Town.
Oh, worked
closely with them. Yeah. So
it stands up. I mean, we're now
15, 16 years after right. It came out.
That movie is going to be watched for, just like Goodfellas and Casino and Heat,
exactly.
That goes into that same category as movies that just will always be watched. And it's great filmmaking, great storytelling, great character acting. I love that.
There's rarefied air in crime movies. And like, you know, and you nailed a few of them, Casino, Goodfellas, both Godfather 1 and 2 and Heat, and there's definitely a spot up there for The Town. It's just
I loved it, and it's so cool that you got to be there and see it firsthand. So just I want to double back to you getting assigned to this case. Kind of take us through your personal law enforcement journey of investigating this, like how you got brought into it.
Yeah, so I got, you know, my goal when I got into the FBI in 95, I wanted to work violent crime. That to me was like what I wanted to do. Bank robbers, armored car robberies, fugitives, kidnappers, right. All that kind of stuff. That's why I wanted
the stuff we see in the town.
Yeah, exactly. Crazy group. You know, I was a transit cop for a few years before I got into the bureau, and I just liked the street. You know, I was down in New York City, and I enjoyed that. I liked being out, hated sitting at a desk. And for the first 5 years in the Bureau, I worked white collar crime or economic crime. And it's really fascinating stuff, but it's not really all that exciting. And so I kept lobbying, whenever there was an overhead page in the office for a bank robbery and, you know, having the task force pick up a call, I'd always just head down there to see if I could help out. And so I finally wormed my way onto the squad in 2000. And then in 2002, I was still like the newest guy on the squad. And my supervisor dropped this case in my lap. And he's like, you know, here, kid, you try this. And it was the Gardner case. And I'd heard about it. I didn't know anything about art, but I'd heard about the case. And I thought it was just absolutely fascinating. And I couldn't have been happier to get assigned the case. I mean, I think it was maybe meant to be like, you know, I don't think it was meant to be a punishment, but I don't think it was meant to be a gift, you know? And so I started working this investigation. The first thing I did is I had to go down and review the case files, because this is 2002. from 1990 to 1995, the Bureau was still using paper files. Right. You know, and it was like a transition to where it was paper with a computerized database. But from 90 to 95, it was all paper, only paper. So I had to go down to the file room, and I was just overwhelmed. I mean, there were like two or three filing cabinets filled with serials, just hundreds and hundreds of serial. Each one is like a file jacket like this. And I was like, where the hell am I going to begin? So I, you know, start at the beginning and just start going through the file. And that's how I learned about it. And my predecessor, unfortunately, was killed in a car accident. And so I didn't have the benefit of talking to him. You know, the FBI is very fact driven. You know, it's the beauty of the FBI. Anything that's in a file is going to be fact. There's no supposition or opinions or hunches in FBI files. And that's great for a prosecution, but it's not good if you're taking it on a cold case. You want to be able to go out with, you know, your predecessor, go out for a cup of coffee and be like, hey, all right, I know what's in the file, but, you know, what do you think? You know, what's your gut tell you? And, you know, what would you do next? And so I didn't have that opportunity. So I had to kind of organically go through this entire file and start learning all these things. And it took a long time because, of course, it wasn't like that was the only thing I'm doing. I mean, we were running down this Charlestown armored car robbery crew, which was a fictionalized depiction, was in the town. And these guys were going out and killing armored car guards and, you know, shooting guards up with AK-47s and M4s. This was no joke. So it took a while to really wrap my head around the case. And so I kind of organically went through the file. And eventually I got to 1998, which is when my predecessor was looking into Carmelo Merlino and his crew. And he had an informant who was into Merlino at his auto shop. It was called TRC Auto Electric down in the Fields Corner neighborhood. And he's having conversations. The source is coming back and saying, yeah, the heist was committed by George Reisfelder and Lenny DiMuzio. These are two members of the crew. These are the guys that dressed up like cops. And there's all this really good information to the point that my predecessor, the agent, went there with an immunity letter to say, hey, you know, Carmelo, you know, give a paintings back. You won't go to jail. So, I mean, this is where it was going. Then they end up getting jammed up because they try and do an armored car robbery, counting house robbery. And they end up getting jammed up. You know, always speculation as to if they had the paintings, why didn't they try and turn them in then? But I think by that point, they'd already gone up to Bobby Garenti in Maine, who was facing his own trouble with the DEA. So that's where I believe the trail kind of severed, because the paintings were up with Garenti. Merlino was not in a position to negotiate them back. And now they're up with Garenti. And that's where the trail went cold. And, you know, just to continue it along, I had all this really good information that's pointing to Merlino and his crew. I mean, some really good information that in and of itself is like crucial evidence, right? There was some, for example, the night of the robbery, about a half hour before the robbery goes down, there's some teenagers. They're coming from a St. Paddy's Day party, and they're kind of stumbling down the street. And they see what they describe as a 1985 to 1988 Dodge Daytona. I mean, it's kind of an unusual car, but it's sitting there, you know, at the curb. And as they get up alongside the car, they look in, and there's two guys in there dressed like Boston cops. Mm-hmm. This is obviously our subjects, because in about 30 minutes, they're going to go ring the bell. That's a pretty unusual vehicle. It's kind of a unique vehicle. And so when I started
my first car there.
Was it really?
My first car.
Yes. Early 1990s.
when I got my license in 93, I think it was 1993. I got an old used Dodge Daytona. Yep.
It was a great car. I mean, obviously
had a unique, look to it. Yes.
It had a unique look. And obviously if you're going to in investigation 101, it's probably not a stolen car. It's probably not a hot box, because if you're going to steal a car because you're going to dress up like cops and go somewhere, you're probably going to steal a Ford LTD or a Caprice Classic or something. I mean, you're not going to steal a Dodge Daytona, a two-door hatchback. Right. So I started really looking into George Reisfelder when I started coming upon this information. And I ran his criminal history, and he got locked up in November of 89. He got locked up 4 months before the Gardner heist for an OUI in the Roslindale section of Boston. And I was thinking to myself, man, can you imagine if he was driving a Dodge Daytona when he got locked up? I mean, that would be incredible. So I had a detective, a Boston detective who worked on the task force with me. I asked her to get a copy of the old police report, which is called a 1-1. And she got it. It's one of these old microfiche, you know, copies, and it's all blotchy. And I looked at it, and sure enough, 4 months before the heist, when he got locked up, he was driving a 1988 Dodge Daytona. It was his car, but he'd registered it up in New Hampshire, and that's why nobody had ever caught it before. So just, you know,
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to.
Yeah, no. So I was going to say, so, you know, just that piece of information is pretty incriminating towards Reisfelder and the Merlino crew. But we also, Anthony from the museum, we also interviewed Reisfelder's brother, who told us that Reisfelder had one of the stolen paintings, Chez Tortoni, a piece by Manet. And it was in his apartment in Quincy 6 weeks after the heist occurred. And George, unfortunately, like a week shy of the 1 year anniversary of the heist, died under very suspicious circumstances. He died of acute overdose of cocaine. And his brother said, hey, listen, George used coke. There's no question about that. But he was terrified of needles. He hated needles. So, I mean, it really kind of seemed like a hot shot. And then after George died, his brother went to the apartment to clean things up, and he said that the painting that was hanging up over George's bed was gone. And so we talked to a source that, you know, has stayed anonymous, who said that that painting went up to Guarenti's house in Maine. And so this is kind of where we were, you know, say circa 2008, 2009. We had all this really good information, and there's a lot more, and it's all in the book, but I'm just giving a couple of examples. But we had all this information that's pointing to Merlino and his crew, but we really have nowhere to go because everybody's dead. And then I get a phone call in September of 2009 from some woman who calls up, and she has this most matter-of-fact tone. It was like a take it or leave it style. She said, hey, listen, it's been long enough. Everybody's dead. These paintings need to come back. My uncle had three or four of the pieces hidden in his house up in Maine. And I, you know, I was mildly interested. I said, oh, okay. You know, who's your uncle? And she said, Bobby Guarenti. And, you know, she got my attention really quickly. And so we went up to Maine, the old house was up there. It was abandoned. We searched it. Found this hide where she described the paintings were hidden. We then went across town to interview Guarenti. Of course, had died in 2004, 2005. We went across town to interview his widow, asked her about it, just talked to her cold about it. She initially denied anything, knowing anything about the paintings, but we kept at it. Then all of a sudden she broke down and said that, yeah, she saw the paintings. It was right after Guarenti got out of jail. And she was present when he handed them off to a guy from Connecticut named Bobby the Cook. And the four Bobby. Of them went out to dinner. And that's Bobby Gentile.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, and it was so organic in the way it happened. I mean, she breaks down and she tells us it's Bobby the Cook. And, you know, this is the first we've heard the name. And we're like, well, you know, who's Bobby the Cook? And she doesn't know his last name, but she's like, I think I might have his phone number somewhere. And she goes into a drawer and pulls out an old address book and starts thumbing through it. And she's like, here it is, Bobby the Cook. And it had a Connecticut area code. And that's what brought us down to Bobby Gentile. And so, I mean, the path was really, it was very linear in how it was done. And, you know, and that's really kind of one of the things that you have to do when you're an investigator, especially if you work in cold cases. I don't care what the case is, what the circumstances are, but whatever you're doing, whatever your goal is in the investigation, whether you're trying to catch a fugitive or catch a murderer or solve a bank robbery, whatever, there's a solution somewhere. And there's going to be a path that's going to lead to that solution. And that path can diverge at different points. But at the end of the day, there are facts, like unassailable facts that are kind of like fence posts you know, and you can tie them together with like a guardrail, and that's your theory. But at the end of the day, you can have all these crazy theories, but it's got to stay along that path. It can't stray too far from the path. And that's what it's like working a cold case. You just have to stay on that path. And there's some really, you know, you'd get some really sexy tips and some cool leads and everything. And you start running them down, because I never wanted to be so myopic that I was like, I'm focused on this. I'm not going to do anything else. Always willing to take new information in. But once it starts straying too far away from those known facts, you got to back up and you got to get back on the path, or you're just going down a rabbit hole.
So let's go from Carmelo Merlino to the guys in Philly and the Joey Merlino guys.
Yeah.
And in this decade between when the heist takes place in March of 1990 and when the Bobby Luisi crew is brought down in 2000.
Yeah. Like, I think it's like June of 99 or that summer of 99. Oh,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You had the paintings and the people that had control of the paintings seemingly go from the Carmelo Merlino people. And now, granted, some of the Carmelo Merlino people then became the Joey Merlino people. And I know, again, it gets confusing. But by the late 90s, it appears to me, in what I've learned, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, that Guarenti, Gentile, Bobby Luisi, whatever knowledge he had or didn't have, that they were under the direction of Joey Merlino and Joey Merlino's consigliere, Giorgio Borghese, and his acting boss, Joe Legambi.
Yep.
I have heard, and I believe you've probably got this tip as well, and this is what I want to ask you about, and if you can go into it, if you're comfortable, that there's two things I want to touch on. First, what happened right at this time period where you're getting the case and in those years surrounding that. I've heard that at least some of the paintings possibly made their way up to Philly to Rittenhouse Square, where there was either a meeting, a negotiation, or an actual sale facilitated by the New England Philly crew through Legambi. Had you heard that at all?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you expand on that at all?
So we start, and I'll work up to it very quickly. We reach out to Bobby Gentile in March of 2010. We sit down with him with his attorney. He claims to know nothing about the Gardner heist. He doesn't know anything about it. And we continue to try and work this angle for months and months. And he's just continuing to be reticent, and he's denying facts that we know are true. We started learning a lot more about him. Like, you know, he got his jaw broken by Frank Zimitti in Connecticut. And then shortly thereafter, Zimitti's car got sprayed with machine gun fire. But Zimitti's kid was driving it going to his prom. Fortunately, nobody got killed. But we find out about that. We find out about one of the other guys who was associated with the Gardner. There was a guy named Jimmy Marks, who was just kind of a small town hood up in Lynn, Massachusetts, a city just north of Boston. Well, yeah. Apparently he was bragging in the months after the heist, he was bragging to his girlfriend that he had a couple of the Gardner Museum paintings. That's hazardous to your health.
You can get you killed.
Yeah. In February of 91, less than a year after the heist occurred, he's up visiting Guarenti up at the house in Maine. They leave together. And a few hours later, he's shotgunned to the back of the head in what the cops referred to as a classic mob hit. Somebody had unscrewed the light bulb on his porch. And a couple of weeks later, homicide detectives, they see Bobby Gentile in the area talking to some of the Jimmy Marks associates. So it's like a lot of interesting stuff is going on. We end up We end up developing, Jamie has a source, Jamie Lawton, my co-case, he had a source at the time who knew Gentile. And Gentile started selling him prescription drugs. And they would sell it out of this Clean Country Cars. It was a car lot in Hartford. And it was Dilaudid and Percocets and OxyContin. And he started selling drugs to the source. And then even sold drugs at one point out of his house. So now we had enough PC to get in and do a search warrant on the house. And it's not like, you know, that you can't phrase it as like Bobby Gentile and his partner, Andy Parenti, were, you know, they were selling meds because they needed, you know, money. No, they were running a pretty lucrative drug operation. They were getting multiple hits from different prescriptions. During one conversation, Gentile was complaining that Tony Volpe, who was running Connecticut at the time, muscling in on his drug sales. I mean, this was, you know, he was a criminal. And so we end up locking him up in February of 2012. We do a search warrant on the house, and we find 7 guns, pump shotgun hanging on a hook by the front door, drugs, high explosives. We have to back out of the house while the bomb squad clears it. And we find like 4 or 5 functioning silencers, which is pretty interesting because we also
pretty got gangster. This guy was a gangster, man.
Yeah, and we got information that Gentile used to make silencers, and you know, at least one of them may have been used in a homicide. So he gets locked up. He still doesn't cooperate. You know, when you're talking about the Gardner heist, this is a guy who's never heard of the Gardner Museum, right? We find a room in his house that is filled with police gear, like utility belts for cops with drop holsters, FBI and police caps, body armor, badge, all these things, which is pretty noteworthy when you think about how the Gardner heist went down. But down in the basement, we find in a drawer the March 19th, 1990 edition of the Boston Herald with the banner headlines on the Gardner heist. This is the guy who's never heard of the Gardner, but he's got the newspaper. Right. And tucked in the newspaper is a handwritten list of all the items that were taken with what looks like a black market value affixed to each one. We track it down. It was written by this guy, Al Munday, the guy that did the first armed museum robbery in Worcester. We interview him. Anthony and I interview him at a hospital in Boston. And he admits that he wrote the list, and he wrote it for Guarenti and Gentile because they claimed to have a buyer for the paintings and they wanted to know what they were worth. So, I mean, this is where we're at. Gentile still doesn't cooperate. He ends up taking 30 months. He takes a polygraph that's given by Ron Barndollar, one of the best FBI polygraphers. He's asked if he knew about the paintings and if he knew about the heist before it happened, if he ever had the paintings. He answers no to all those questions. Fails them all miserably, but he still ends up taking the 30 months. And while he's locked up, 2 of his closest friends become FBI sources. And Ronnie Bowes, whose nickname was Meatball, and another guy, Sammy Mazzucato. And these guys told us, like, they gave such a wealth of information about Gentile and his actions with these paintings. Like, they told us that after Gentile and Guarenti and Luisi got made, Gentile and Guarenti had an argument because Guarenti thought that they should give the Philly mob one of the pieces as tribute, as thanks for getting them straightened out. Gentile, so greedy, was against it because he said these paintings are way too valuable to give one away. But
Luisi wanted to give it away or Guarenti?
Guarenti. Guarenti wanted to give it away. Right. And so, and by the way, when Jamie and I spoke to Luisi in 2012, we asked him about the paintings, and he said that, yeah, like Guarenti told them they were watching TV one day at Luisi's apartment in Woburn shortly after the heist occurred. And the Gardner, something comes on about the Gardner, and Guarenti says to him, "I know where those are. Do you think you know anybody who'd want to buy them?" And Luisi said, "I don't want anything to do with them. They're too hot. I can't find a buyer for that." But Meatball, one of the sources, my source, you know, he was a triple murderer. He was convicted for a triple murder down in Florida. Like, he was the real deal. But he was very trustworthy to us. And he told us that at one point he was in Gentile's auto shop called Gem Auto in South Windsor, Connecticut. And Gentile takes this big box and he slides out what he says, what Meatball says, is the Rembrandt Storm on the Sea of Galilee. It's Rembrandt's big seascape, one of the pieces stolen in the heist. And Gentile says, you know how much this thing is worth? And Meatball says, I have no idea. And he says, it's worth nothing. Nobody wants it. But the next day, or day two after, Gentile has Meatball drive a poultry truck with a guy named John Jackma, Jack Ma. And the two of them, and the two of them drive it down to the outskirts of Philly to a warehouse and unload a few boxes. And Meatball thinks one of the boxes was the one that he'd seen previously with the with the Rembrandt in it. And Meatball never saw what was in it. You know, he told us that this is, like I said, this is a triple murderer. And he said he'd never been so nervous as when he was driving down to Philly in that poultry truck. And they unloaded those boxes at this warehouse. And Meatball's convinced that he just delivered the Gardner paintings down to Philly. And, you know, we had source information. You know, I've spoken and I interviewed him for the book, Dave Schrattweiser, who's a Philly mob reporter.
And friend of the show.
Yeah.
Shout out to Dave. Shout out to Anthony Amore, by the way, the great investigator at the museum.
Phenomenal.
He does work that is thankless, and we want to thank him and hope that he sees this episode and enjoys it. But
spoiler alert, we never got the paintings back, but we did a lot of investigation, a lot of hard work, and none of it would have been possible like as a one-man show. This was everything we worked as a team. We even had shirts made up that said the Gardner Theft Task Force. You know, it was Anthony, Jamie, myself, and then the prosecutors with Rob Fisher, Brian Kelly, and John Durham. We just had this really tight team all working together. And, Dave's sources down in Philly told him, and he, you know, when we were talking about this for my book, his sources were reporting that a few of these paintings came down to the Philadelphia area and they were dropped off in a warehouse outside of Philly, which comports with the information that I was getting from Meatball. I mean, it's like, it's really dovetailing. And then the information was that it went to a guy in Rittenhouse Square, which is one of the posh sections of Philly.
Right.
And from there, the question is what happened to him? And that's kind of where the trail went cold. And, you know, My goal, and it's the title of the book, 13 Perfect Fugitives. The reason why I call it that is when I got this case in 2002, the statute of limitations on the theft had been expired for 7 years.
Right.
The FBI has a dog in the fight because there's no statute of limitations for possession of stolen property. But I got a case where, like, everybody's dead. It's been 12 years have passed. Like, how am I going to work this case? And so I chose to work it like a fugitive investigation. Like, this is more, we're trying to apprehend these 13 fugitives rather than, because we can't put anybody in jail for the theft because that's expired. So that was kind of the way I worked the case. And publicity was key. I call them perfect fugitives because, unlike human fugitives, you know, these guys don't have to go get a driver's license or, you know, go grocery shopping. They can just hide out somewhere. And so that's why I always worked at trying to exploit publicity. We did billboard campaigns. We did social media videos and whatnot and tweeted and all that stuff. But with all this information that we had, and we kind of hit another dead end in the investigation down in 2013. And so we were confident, and we still are, that we knew who did this heist, who pulled it off, and various places that these paintings had gone to over the years. And so because of that, the FBI, in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Gardner Museum, we did a joint press conference in March of 2013 to say that the case was solved. And yeah, the U.S. Attorney's Office, in an abundance of caution, they didn't want to list the names of the people involved. You know, we get that. Even though we were concerned that there might be a little bit of blowback that people will think we're bluffing. And there are some people who've said that. I'm disappointed to hear them say that. But, it wasn't a bluff. You know, we wanted to get this information out, and our publicity, this fugitive hunt, had really always been contained into like the Boston area, maybe a little bit down into Connecticut and New Hampshire. But now that we had this really credible information that these paintings, there's a good chance they went down to the Philadelphia area, we wanted to expand that publicity. And that's why there were billboards up on the highways down in eastern Pennsylvania, because we were hoping and still hope that it might resonate with somebody, that somebody's going to say, hey, I saw that piece once, and they're going to come forward with it, because there is a $10 million reward for their recovery.
Can I present you some reporting of mine, and that I'm very confident in the sourcing, and I can say, I hope Dave doesn't mind me speaking for him, but I can say that Dave has been able to confirm this as well, and I want to get your take on it. I don't know if you've heard it or not.
I'll do what I can.
Okay. So over here at the OG Pod, we consider ourselves the foremost expert in terms of the people that are out there reporting today. And Dave and George are obviously the expert, but they're not really doing day-to-day reporting. So I don't include them when I say that we're the foremost, because they're the foremost. But for people that are doing the day-to-day in 2026, we consider ourselves the foremost experts on Skinny Joey Merlino and his legacy and his biography and his, he's, in our opinion, and the most consequential, at least in terms of popular culture, the most consequential mafia don of the last 30 years. And he is just a never ending story of being a true blue gangster. And he's podcasting now and all that. But I want to bring us back to when Joey got out of prison in the winter or late winter of 2011. And I'm told, and this is, again, very well sourced, that one of Joey Merlino's one of the first things on his post-incarceration agenda was to round up these paintings, and that he had meetings with his lieutenants over the next couple of years, that this was a concerted effort by Merlino to put out word to anybody he knew that could somehow bring him these paintings, so he could then return the paintings to the museum and the FBI and collect the $10 million reward. That Merlino was, I don't want to say obsessed, but this was a very planned out thing where he, for a year or two, he thought he was going to get rich off of those paintings by putting out feelers to his underworld sources, and that they would somehow come together on an agreement to bring the paintings back to the authorities. How much weight do you put in that? I know this happened, but I don't know what the real chances were that he'd be able to do that.
Yeah, and I don't have the answer to that as to whether or not he'd be able to do it. But yeah, I mean, I was contacted from people from time to time who had heard from Philly looking for the painting. So, you know, and to your point, that's exactly what we were trying to have happen, right? We wanted very much to get people to start talking about it, and maybe it would stir things up, and maybe it would shake the trees a little bit, and somebody might come forward with something. You know, to get to that point of the $10 million reward, the museum will not pay the reward to anyone who was actually directly involved in the robbery, because that would be a ransom. And that's, you know, moral. I completely agree with that. But, you know, I don't believe, from what we've talked about and what's in my book, I don't believe that anybody down in Philadelphia was involved in the heist.
Joey was in prison, by the way, in 1990.
Yes. He was
locked up.
Right. So the point is that if anybody down in Philadelphia were to come forward with these paintings, they would be eligible for the reward. And that was what we were doing. And we were trying to get people talking down in Philadelphia to say, hey, find these paintings, because it really, it's like a $10 million lottery ticket.
I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I'd be remiss not to bring this up and have you comment on it if you feel comfortable.
Sure.
And that is the belief and the theory that there was a murder committed by the New England Philadelphia Mafia crew, or the New England crew that reported to Philadelphia. That's these same group of people that had possession of the Gardner Museum pieces, allegedly, and the guys that you were looking at, in a similar way that you said that Bobby Guarente wanted to maybe offer up a painting as tribute for the people that made them. I'm told that there's a theory. It doesn't mean it's true, but there is a theory that they did the same thing for a murder that took place in Philadelphia in April of 1999. This was right before everybody was arrested. The murder was actually reinvigorated. The investigation was recently reinvigorated, and there was an arrest last fall or last summer. The arrest is of someone from South Philly named Richard Lighty. He's pled not guilty, but I'm told currently that the Boston gangsters, the ones that are dead, maybe ones that are alive, are still considered suspects in that murder, and that some of the people that you've mentioned tied into this Gardner Museum angle, even some of the lesser known names, you mentioned Jack Jackma.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard he's dead. I've heard that he was somebody that allegedly brought guns and silencers to Philadelphia from Gentile and Guarante to possibly the hit team that did this, the Gino Marconi hit in April of 1999. And this kind of plays in the same timeline as some of this Gardner Museum stuff. Had you heard that this crew was a suspect in a murder in Philadelphia?
So I'm going to have to pass on that just because I wouldn't.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about, obviously, there's no statute on murder.
Yep.
But it's just, I would never talk about another division's cases. Okay. Or anything. I don't want to jam anything up that they're doing.
It's all right. I just wanted to put out there that it's more than just the paintings and Joey Merlino and that New England crew. And even now, 27 years later, there's been an arrest. And I'm told there could be more arrests in the future. And the only reason I shouldn't say the only reason I'm bringing it up. One of the reasons I bring it up is, in the way my mind works, potentially some type of domino effect in possibly solving the Marconi murder could bring you closure in the museum heist.
Yeah. Look, all these things are possible. And, you know, to get to your point about a lot of people have said to me over the years, like, why don't these people turn these paintings in? I mean, they're just paintings, you know, and if you look at the actual theft that it went down, it was actually pretty clever, right? You know, I mean, no guns were shown. Nobody got hurt. It had all the makings of like kind of a Thomas Crown Affair type, you know, robbery with no bloodshed.
Except these guys were a bunch of bumbling idiots that didn't know what they were looking for.
Exactly.
And they stumbled upon $500 million. If they knew what they were looking for, they could have gotten $5 billion.
Yeah, I think they could have done a lot better. But, you know, for criminals, everybody's heard of Rembrandt. Rembrandt's are like the Ferrari of the art world. Everybody's heard of it. You know, nobody knows about Holbeins or Durers or Raphaels or Titians, but everybody knows about Rembrandts. But the point is that, you know, that when people have said to me, like, oh, you know, why don't they just turn them in? They're just all, you know, it's just all paintings. There's two important things. And without getting back to your point that you just made, there are up in Boston, there are three or four homicides that are, I believe, connected to, at least tangentially connected to, the Gardner theft. And there's no statute on homicide. And on the other side of the coin, you know, yeah, sure, interesting, you know, you're transporting stolen property across state lines. What's the big deal? Well, it's one of the predicate acts for a RICO prosecution. And so, you know, I think there's a genuine fear. If there are people out there who right now, you know, potentially watching this podcast, or like, I know where at least one of these pieces is located, there's a fear that you come forward with it, you're going to somehow implicate yourself in a homicide, or you're going to somehow implicate yourself in a RICO prosecution because the stolen property is one of the predicate acts. And so, you know, I've always said that's not the goal of this investigation. We're not trying to use it as some type of backdoor to take down an LCN crew or anything like that. I mean, we're really trying to get these paintings back because it's the right thing to do. And so I've always suggested, hey, if you've got information, you're concerned about it, go through an attorney, have an attorney call the museum or call the FBI and work out a deal that these paintings can get returned without even having to identify who you are.
As we wrap up here, I want to pick your brain just for maybe another couple minutes, and then we'll let you be on your way. But I'm maybe this is the elephant in the room, and I just want to kind of throw it out there. I don't think this is going to shock you, but it might, I guess, surprise people that are just kind of encountering this story and trying to learn about it and try to figure it out, put all the puzzle pieces together. What if the big elephant in the room here is that it's not that people have access to the paintings and that they're not bringing them back for whatever reason? What if nobody knows where the paintings are now? And the reason that nobody's returning them is because nobody has access to them and they're sitting hidden somewhere by people that did it or got possession of them later on, and those people are gone. So what if it is a situation where they're just lost? They're not necessarily being hidden.
Oh, that's a definite possibility. And you have to realize we're talking about 13 pieces. So, and you know, when I kind of gave the scenario we were talking about a few pieces going up to Maine, a few down to Connecticut, a few down to Philly. There's been like this common theme. There's 13 pieces. And I'll tell you right now, I've always been very upfront about this. Some of the pieces, like Govart Flank's landscape with an obelisk, or this very large Rembrandt Lady and Gentleman in Black, I've never spoken to anybody over the 22 years I've worked the case who's seen it, whether or not it's a really credible sighting or not. Nobody's ever mentioned it. And that gets back to what I've talked about. When you look at three or four people connected with this heist, suddenly dying within, you know, 15, 16 months of the heist occurring, I think it is very possible that some of these pieces were hidden, and they were hidden really well. And that's not a bad thing, Scott, to be honest with you. You know, when you're looking at, you know, as an investigator working art theft cases, and I did it for more than 20 years, when you're doing that, you've got to look to the past to judge your future success. And art theft recoveries typically either occur right after a theft occurs, or it's going to be generational. Oftentimes it comes back because somebody dies and the family's going through their house, or they're going through a safety deposit box, and all of a sudden they come upon these illicit treasures. That happened to me. The last thing I did in the FBI, the week I retired, I was able to repatriate these 22 objects that have been looted from Okinawa at the end of World War II. And it had happened that 80 years later, this World War II veteran passed away, and his family was going through his house and came upon all these beautiful Asian treasures. And they're like, wait a minute, Dad doesn't collect this stuff. They called the FBI. I got the case, and it turned out that they'd been looted in 1945. Like 80 years later, we were able to give them back. And that's a perfect example about it. So I think they're definitely out there. Some could be hidden, and some may not get discovered until somebody's doing a home renovation, or, you know, somebody's doing an estate sale. But they will be found. It's just a question of when.
It is definitely one of the more compelling or riveting mysteries in American history, whether you're talking about the mob or the art world or, you know, any mystery related to anything. I mean, this is it's one of the you could sit here and I could talk about this for another 20 hours with you and I'll still be interested in it. All of the granulars fascinate me. I hope we can have you on again. And when we have maybe new developments in the case, you can come on and talk to our audience. We're going to bring Jeff back on shortly to talk about just his general work with the Boston La Cosa Nostra group. I'd also love to have you on to talk about your work busting bank robbers in Charlestown and working on the town. So we got
a lot of fun stuff to talk about.
I would love to bring you back on and get into that, because you've done it all. You've seen it all. We owe a debt to people like yourself that gave three decades of your life fighting the good fight for the U.S. government. And we thank you so much. And thank you for joining us, and let everybody know where they can get 13 Perfect Fugitives.
13 Perfect Fugitives. You can go to Amazon. It's available at Amazon, Simon & Schuster. Website, Barnes & Noble, or you can go directly to my website, jeffreykelly.com, Jeffrey with a G, check it out there. But I appreciate you having me on the show, Scott. It was fun talking about it. It's still fascinating for me to talk about it.
Last question, I promise. This is more creative than talking about your career. Reflecting back on the authoring process of the first book you ever read. First book you ever wrote. Hopefully it wasn't the first book you read. What was the process like? Was it very rewarding? Was it something you enjoyed, or was it more laborious?
It was, I should say here that, you know, it was a terrible process, but it wasn't. I really enjoyed it. It was almost kind of cathartic for me. There was so much that I wanted to talk about, because there's so much fascinating little details about this case that have occurred over, you know, the 36 years. And it's like, there's so many little vignettes and stories, and I really enjoyed writing it. And, I think my publisher had a general limit for how long the book would be. And I probably would have gone on for another 200 or 300 pages, because there's just so many little fun stories and anecdotes. So I enjoyed writing it. And, I hope people enjoy reading it.
Well, I can just give you some early reaction feedback from the online community. People are loving it on the chat forums, people that go online to have conversations about organized crime or true crime books, movies, reporting and all. And I can just see people over these last couple of weeks. They love it. They think it's so deep. It's very detailed and very dense. And they love the new perspective on something that we've known about for a while, and there's been a book or two written about it, but never from the perspective of the person in the FBI assigned to this case for two decades. So everybody go grab it. If you want to learn about this case, this is the Bible. So Jeffrey, thank you so much. Jeff Kelly. You've done it all. You've seen it all. You've lived a movie. Hopefully one day we'll have a movie about all of this.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you. Happy to come
back.
Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you to Benny, our producer. And please like, share, and subscribe. The Original Gangsters. For Jeff, for Ben, I'm Scott Bernstein. Original Gangsters News Network and Podcast, Uncovering the Underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. We're out.